coming up on today's program.
There were probably 10 years where I didn't tell anybody I was a veteran, you know, because I wasn't interested in feeling like it was the mantle I had to carry around. But over the last 10 years or so, I've been working to kind of make sense of that.
Military veterans and the arts. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. As always, thanks for sharing your weekend with WISO. That story coming up later in the program. Also, Juliet Frumholt shares a conversation she had with a very special guest on Kaleidoscope this past week. Up first, let's flip this program on its head.
You're listening to WISO Weekend here on WYSO. I am not the normal host of WISO Weekend. I am Mike Fraser, the local host for Morning Edition. I am here interviewing the man, the myth, the legend, known as Jerry Kenney. Hey, Jerry.
Pleased to be here, Mike.
We often don't see each other. We're like two ships passing in the night.
Yeah. So it's rare that we're at the studios together. But we wanted to work out this conversation. You and I spoke recently to get our listeners to know a little bit more about you. And so we're going to turn the tables this week.
So the spotlight is on you. Yeah. So, Jerry, what is your origin story, your WISO origin story?
Yeah, so I think I was in my mid-20s, and one of my best friends said he was driving up to Yellow Springs to donate to a radio station and asked if I wanted to join him. I said sure, even though I thought the concept of giving money to a radio station was a little strange. I mean, radio's free, right? So we drove up there on a fall day. It was a beautiful fall day during their fund drive when they had tables set up around so you could meet the people in radio. That's where I met Ruth Dawson, who later became Ruth Yellowhawk, and just a lovely person. Met her for the first time. And just because of that visit, I started listening to WISO and hearing programs that I had never heard before, like This Way Out, an LGBT news magazine, or WINGS, a Women's International News Gathering Service. Just all these voices that you don't get on commercial radio. So I started listening more and more. And then probably after about a year, you know, of listening to the occasional fund drives and requests for donations, I said, you know what? I'm listening enough now. I got to give. So I became a donating listener, and I would get the quarterly newsletter they used to send out. And in one newsletter, they were asking for volunteers. So I thought, hey, that'd be cool. I'll volunteer at the station. So I called, and it was Ruth Dawson that I spoke with. She invited me to come up and speak with her and get a tour of the station. And that was also in the Student Union building. So pretty humble digs. This was the early 90s. So came up, talked to her. She said, we'd love to have you volunteer. And so I expected to, you know, just come up and stuff envelopes or do something, some kind of office work or something. But she asked if I wanted to learn how to operate the board. And I was like, really? You'll let me do that? So I spent the next probably 6 months. It was a great summer. I would come up every Saturday and operate the board for Bob Reamer, who hosted Unified Field Theory on Saturday afternoons. A really great music show, and I still have some cassette recordings of that program. So that was my start. And then general manager at the time, Brian Gibbons, was also hosting the second half of Alpha Rhythms on Sunday nights from 9 to midnight, but he was also hosting Morning Edition the next morning. So I just called Ruth one day and said, you know, if Brian ever needs a break, I would love to try and fill in on Sunday night. And she said, oh, okay, great. Well, yeah, I'll get back to you. She called me actually like within an hour or two and said, hey, Brian asked if you're interested in filling in this Sunday.
That was quick.
Yeah, it was very quick. And so I filled in that Sunday, and I filled in the next Sunday, and then I filled in for the next 18 years. He never came back to the to the program. So that was my start with WISO.
Well, you must have been pretty good at it.
Yeah. Oh, no. I was terrible. I believe you mentioned last week that you were pretty bad. I'm really shocked that they allowed me to stay on the air. In fact, I had this big speech written out for my first night on the radio, ever solo. And so I said, thanks to Brian and thanks for Why So for giving me the opportunity. And then I hit my first song. And the person before me, Lori Taylor, had switched off the record players.
Oh,
so
no.
So I give this grand speech thanking everybody, and it's like a minute 30 of silence until she comes back in the room and she's like, oh, I'm sorry. So, yeah, that was my big start on the music scene.
A humble start, but a beginning of a long...
Yeah, I really enjoyed co-hosting. We would kind of mix it up. She would do the first 2 hours because Alpha Rhythms was a five-hour program back then. So then I would do the final 3 hours, or sometimes we do that middle hour together. So it was just nice. And I was a big fan of the music before I ever volunteered.
And you still do Alpha Rhythms now and then?
I did. I took a break when I was hired to do Morning Edition in 2007. I managed to do Alpha Rhythms for maybe another year. And then having to work so early, I was in the shoes that Brian Gibbons was in. So I decided to take a break, and Juliet Fromholt was on board by then. Justin Vanderberg was co-hosting. We trained him. So I left the show in what I thought was very capable hands. And Juliet is still hosting that today. And then just a few years ago, I got the urge to start co-hosting again. So she very graciously gave up the final hour, the 10 to 11 o'clock hour, so that I could come back and spin some music.
It is nice hosting a music show. I miss doing that, I have to admit.
Yeah, it's great, and I'm still a big fan of ambient new age music.
Now, did you start with Morning Edition first or All Things Considered?
I actually started with All Things Considered first. I worked here part-time, I guess. For about 8 months, I hosted All Things Considered. And that came about because I was let go from a job that I really hated. So it was a complete blessing. I put together a resume and gave it to the program director at the time and said, I've got lots of free time if there's anything else you want me to do. And at that time, he had been approached by the current All Things Considered host, who had said they needed to step back and take care of their father. So the timing was just right. Called me very soon after I handed my resume in and said, hey, how do you feel about doing news in the afternoons? So I did that for 8 months, and then the Morning Edition job came open.
You did Morning Edition for how long?
Oh, gosh, 6 years, and then transitioned back to All Things Considered.
And you've been there ever since?
Yeah. What is that, 18 years?
That's quite a tenure.
As full-time staff. So.
Yeah. Well, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
So I shared some war stories, humbling war stories. Do you have any similar war stories?
What comes to mind immediately is... And I'm sure you've done this too, been in a situation where you've had to host both shows, morning and afternoon. So I was Morning Edition host, but I had filled in for All Things Considered. So I just thought, you know what, I'm going to prepare everything for the next morning and maybe just kind of cruise in a little later than normal. So I had all my newscasts lined up by the time I left after All Things Considered, and everything was going according to plan. I got here to the station just before 6 o'clock, and you know that first newscast is at 6:04.
Yep.
But everything was ready. I knew where it was. I could just open up the mic and go on the air. It was all prepared. So I got out of my car, put my backpack on, and I had a Starbucks coffee, and you know, feeling good. Everything's in place. I did a little hop, skip, jump up the steps to the Fells building, because you would enter from the alleyway, and I tripped. And I fell forward, lost my coffee, hit my forehead on one of the steps.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was complete wipeout.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I kind of like got up, shook it off, and I'm like, well, darn, there goes my coffee. It was a nice full cup of hot coffee, too. So I still, according to plan, you know, at 6:04, I'm standing there. I've got my newscasts ready, and I start reading the news, and I notice there's just a little wetness running down my forehead. So I did that newscast with blood running down my face.
Wow, so, you actually shed blood. For
yes.
Blood, sweat.
Yes. So I guess that you can count that as a war story with wounds.
With wounds. That's dedication. That's dedication.
Yep.
So besides being the voice of Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and occasionally Alpha Rhythms, what else do you do in your spare time?
spare time, I'm really into fitness, actually, at this point. So I'll be 61 very soon. And the kind of mentality that I should have had in my younger years has finally clicked. So, you know, not looking backward, just looking forward. So I really enjoy getting out, walking the neighborhood, or I've joined the Payne Recreation Center out in Moraine. I walk the riverbank there next to the, there's a small airport out there as well. It's great. Sometimes I'll catch a plane flying, just taking off right overhead. So it's just beautiful out there. So I'm walking a lot. I've started weight training and doing some other exercises. I've still got to get on board with some like stretching and martial arts. Tossing that idea around.
It's good to stay flexible, and you know, you and I are pretty close in age.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm also trying to keep mind of my physical abilities or lack thereof, and you know, try to stay as limber as we approach that phase in our lives.
Yeah.
Feeling better about it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Actually, I can say this, I've lost 35 pounds in the last year.
You so look thinner, actually.
I'm really feeling pretty good these days.
Good. Glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Well, nice. Jerry Kenny, the man, myth, legend. I don't see any scars on your forehead, so I think you healed pretty well from that that ordeal from years ago.
I did. Life goes on.
Yes. All right. Well, Jerry, I guess we'll pass it back to you here on Why So Weekend.
All right. Thanks for speaking with me, Mike.
All right. Take care.
You too. That interview is actually part of a series of conversations we have with WISO staff members. You can find more of them on our website at wyso.org. And now that we're right side up, up next on the program, this week on Veterans Day, we kicked off a new season of Veterans Voices. This time, we're exploring the connection between military service and the arts, starting in Columbus at the Rife Center for Government and the Arts, home to a new exhibit featuring the work of veteran artists.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Kat Sheridan. I'm the director of the Ohio Arts Council's Rife Gallery. We are so glad that you could join us to celebrate veteran art in Ohio. This year, we have 37 phenomenal pieces by 23 artists.
I'm Daniel King. I'm an artist and educator and veteran of the U.S. Air Force. I'm a lens-based artist, which means that I work a lot with photography, both digital and film photography, and what might be called just purely studio visual art, so printmaking, bookmaking, trying to find ways to explore what photography was before the camera was invented. So proto-photography sorts of things like cyanotype prints and, you know, pinhole cameras and that kind of thing where, you know, the technology is just not a crutch anymore and it's more about making an impression with light. Most of my work doesn't feature military themes or veteran story or any kind of like obvious connection on the surface, but one of the threads that I've been pulling on, the sort of complications that come with finding yourself at odds with what the military is doing or being tasked with or being sent out to do, and how do I make sense of that? There were probably 10 years where I didn't tell anybody I was a veteran, you know, because I wasn't interested in feeling like it was the mantle I had to carry around. But over the last 10 years or so, I've been working to kind of make sense of that.
Now it's my honor to introduce the Ohio Department of Veteran Services Major General John C. Harris, Jr. Help me welcome Director Harris.
It's really an honor to stand here with you today, a celebration of creativity. Every piece on these walls tells a story. Now I'd like to introduce to you our juror for 2025, Daniel King.
Some folks from the Department of Veterans Affairs reached out to me and asked if I would be interested in jurying the show, and I liked that it was a statewide initiative and that the submissions were coming in from all over. My interest over the last 5 or 6 years has been to become more involved with artists who are veterans. I've been doing a lot of workshops through the Central Ohio VA Medical Center. They have a veteran artist initiative through their whole health program. I think veterans who want to get into the arts benefit from making connection with other veteran artists who are doing it so that they have a kind of shared experience to start with. You know, they're in the same place when they start. And I think that's what I've experienced with the workshops that I've taught. And it was like a really interesting experience because we would start one day, hands in the, you know, paint, making art. And then the next day we would just talk for most of the time. You know, we wouldn't like worry too much about making the art. But I think finding ways to give veterans the permission to just say what they want to say and make the picture they want to make, but you have to give yourself permission to do it.
I'm an artist, an educator, and an Air Force veteran myself. The art on the wall will reveal, among other things, that we have complex feelings and thoughts and desires that all human beings share. We veterans are, surprise, human beings like everybody else.
The Veterans Art Exhibition is on display at the Vern Reif Center for Government and the Arts in downtown Columbus through December 6th. Veterans Voices is presented by Wright-Patt Credit Union. Additional support comes from the Dayton Ombudsman Veterans Transition Team and Montgomery County Veterans Service Commission. Veterans Voices is produced here at the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at WYSO. So let's delve a little deeper into the arts. Harvard history professor Sarah Lewis is speaking later today at the John Legend Theater in Springfield. Lewis is an author and the founder of the Vision and Justice Civic Initiative, where she generates original research and programs that reveal what she calls the foundational role of visual culture in America's representational democracy. WISO's Lee Wade spoke with Lewis about why she thinks her work is relevant to the Springfield community.
You know, creativity, the arts, is often seen as this luxury and respite from life. But what's central to all the work I do is showing through historic examples and urgent contemporary ones how critical visuality, how critical media, how critical culture is for defining who counts and who belongs in American life. So yes, we will touch on recent politics in not only the local community in Ohio, but the national narrative that it became. And we'll do so in a way that lets us think through the hidden and, I think, underappreciated tactics for redefining the civic imagination, namely the work of culture and the work of the arts.
The Vision and Justice Initiative looks at how art shapes who we see as a part of the American story. What sparked that idea for you, and why does it feel especially timely today?
Vision and Justice began with the publication of the Aperture issue in 2016 and the Vision and Justice course at Harvard. I asked myself this question that was inspired by my grandfather, the work of Frederick Douglass, many other leaders. What is the role of art and culture for the democratic imagination, for defining who counts and who belongs? I had this prompt really given to me by my grandfather. He was in a New York City public school in the 11th grade and wanted to know why the textbooks in that year of 1926 didn't present the world around them as it was in Brooklyn, New York. And the teacher told him that African Americans in particular did nothing to merit inclusion in those textbooks. And so he was expelled for his so-called impertinence and refusing to accept that answer. He became an artist, a visual artist, sort of a proto Cahen de Wiley, like creating these genre paintings where he knew he should be, that he knew he should be able to find in those textbooks, where he presented the world as it exists fully. And he also became a jazz musician. And when I graduated from Harvard and he died, I didn't know why my grandfather had never graduated from high school. I didn't know this story and was told. And it seemed to me that he was asking this central question as he became an artist, you know, what is the work of being seen justly, right, for representational democracy? What is the role of visual representation in the democratic imagination? And he really sacrificed to stand up for the answer that, yes, it matters far more than we've understood. And that prompted the journey, you know, that prompted the research, that prompted my understanding of Frederick Douglass's speech, Pictures in Progress, which languished after being so carefully preserved in the Library of Congress for over 150 years, with no one really understanding what Douglass took pains to explain during the Civil War, that pictures, that images, that culture were going to be the way to correct this, the dehumanized gaze that was conditioned through slavery, the crisis of regard we're still in today, the near inability to see the other as just like you. He became the most photographed American man as a result, you know, putting before us an image of a self-possessed Black man when the Constitution stated that, you know, we as African Americans were 3/5 human beings. So I started to research the foundations of this idea and launched the initiative, which is now radial through publications and public programs and the course at Harvard, to address the historic foundations of this concept and how it emerges in contemporary life through not just artistic practice, but through political initiatives of all kinds.
Sarah, what do you hope people walk away with after attending your lecture?
Inspired, empowered, with a call to action to address the work of art, creativity, and their own vision for imagining the more just future that we all deserve.
That was WISO's Lee Wade speaking with Sarah Lewis about today's Westcott Lecture at the John Legend Theater in Springfield. The event is free and open to the public. Doors open at 3:30 this afternoon. Up next on WISO Weekend, a little conversation and music. Here's Juliet Frumholtz, WISO Music Director, to introduce her special guest on Kaleidoscope this past week.
Almost exactly 2 weeks to the moment to when we'll be hearing that song as part of Such a Night, The Last Waltz Live. It's happening on Wednesday, November 26th at Victoria Theater, and of course, benefits WYSO. We'll have over 25 of our best and brightest Dayton musicians involved in that show once again this year. And as we have been getting ready for this year's show, I had the opportunity to talk with somebody who was in attendance at the original Last Waltz. Dennis McCaffrey is based in San Francisco. He's going to be visiting for our Such a Night, The Last Waltz Live. But he was there in 1976 for the original show. Here's a bit of our conversation about that experience. Tell me a little bit about what brought you to that concert there in San Francisco.
Well, I was living and working in San Francisco at the time. I was actually in retail records, and the show was announced not long before. I mean, maybe a week before. It was put together really quickly, and it sold out immediately. Winterland only held about 5,000 people, and it was only going to be one show. So sold out immediately before I got a ticket, but I asked one of the record companies, and I was able to, usually I'd get free tickets from them, but I had to buy a ticket. And they were very expensive. As I recall, it was $50, which at that time, you could see the band for maybe $10 or $15. It was a very expensive show, but it included also a full Thanksgiving dinner. So I was very excited to get the tickets. I was very excited to go.
Most people kind of don't realize or forget that this was a full Thanksgiving dinner, in addition to a concert that went all night long, from my understanding. What was the sort of vibe in the room as you were all enjoying your turkey dinners before the show started?
Well, I admit I did not have the turkey dinner. I went with a girl. She wanted to have turkey dinner with her family, so we did that. And then we drove up to San Francisco to Winterland, and I'm not sure what time we got there, 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock. So the dinner was still going on. The concert was a long time till it started. So they wrapped up the dinner, and then they had to clear the floor because it had tons of tables and chairs set up on the floor for people to eat dinner. There was also a waltz chamber orchestra playing, and Bill Graham had gotten decorations from the San Francisco Opera. He had chandeliers and stage curtains and stuff like that from the San Francisco Opera. So it was really amazing, but they had to move everybody off the floor because most people, when you went to Winterland, would sit on the floor but then stand during the show. So I had to clear all the furniture off so people could get back onto the floor before they could start the show. And it's been 49 years. I don't remember what time the show started, but it was a late starting show.
Yeah, by all reports I've read, it started like 9:30-ish. So, much later than people were arriving, obviously, between the dinner and everything.
Yeah, people came for dinner probably at 7. I'm not really sure what time.
When you decided you wanted to go to the show, did you know all of the special guests that were going to be there? Okay.
They weren't announced at all. It said the band was going to perform their final concert with special guests. When people said special guests, everybody presumed it was Bob Dylan. And everybody was expecting to see Bob Dylan. And that's why they went. They didn't announce any of the guests that I remember. And they didn't announce Bob Dylan either. I remember reading the paper, maybe the day of the show or the day before the show, that Bob Dylan was seen at the Miyako Hotel where they were staying. But I don't remember knowing anybody else was going to be there. So every act that was announced was a surprise.
That had to be such a jaw-dropping moment because, I mean, these were some of just the best and brightest of their time, you know, as person after person, you know, came out on the stage. What was that like from a crowd perspective?
Well, because each one was a big surprise. It was like, you know, delight when they announced Neil Young or Joni Mitchell or Van Morrison. And Van Morrison at the time was one of my just overwhelming favorites. I loved Van Morrison. So, you know, I had no idea he was going to be there. So it was really, you know, exciting to see him. And I loved the band, and they were great. And they never left the stage. You know, they played their own songs. They backed up everybody else. They were just on stage for hours and hours. It was really incredible.
Is there a particular song or moment in the show that sticks out to you?
Well, so many, but Bob Dylan coming out and playing Baby Let Me Follow You Down, which was on his first album from 1962, I think, you know. So it was... And they played it great. I saw Bob Dylan four times over the years, twice with the band and twice without. The two times with the band, he was great. The two times without, he really wasn't very good. So the band brought out the best in Bob Dylan. And Forever Young, you know, I really liked that song. It was great to hear that. I Don't Believe You was on, you know, one of his very first albums, maybe the second or third album that song was on. It was a song I'd always loved to, you know, and it's great to hear it live. So seeing everybody was great, but Bob Dylan really was the topper.
What has it been like watching this concert, this, you know, now a film obviously as well, but this moment in musical history and obviously your personal history endure over the decades?
Well, it's I've been to a few of like the historic concerts of rock and roll. This is certainly one of them. And the band, you know, never had the popular acclaim of some big selling bands who sold millions and millions of records. The band weren't like that, but they were easily probably the most respected band among other musicians, you know, who loved them, and critics, of course, loved them, you know, because they were so great. And you tell people now, or even back then, oh, I'm going to see the band, their last concert, or I was at the last waltz. A lot of people who aren't really, you know, hardcore music fans, you know, what's the big deal, or who is the band? You know, so some people just don't get it. But people who do get it, you know, it's great to talk to them, you know, to hear their memories, because they were really, really good.
All A big thank you to Dennis McCaffrey for sharing his Last Waltz experience with us. And a big, big thank you to Rob Degenhart for facilitating that introduction. You can join us at Such a Night, The Last Waltz Live, right here in Dayton, Ohio, on Wednesday, November 26th at Victoria Theater. Tickets are going very quickly. The floor is almost full. You can get yours at DaytonLive.org, or you can find a link from WYSO.org under the Events tab.
This is Bird Note. In winter, flocks of white geese gather by the thousands in fields and marshes of the U.S. and Mexico. All the birds in this flock flying through North Texas have white bodies, black-tipped wings, and pink legs. But on closer inspection, they appear to come in two different sizes. That's because this flock is a mix of both the petite Ross's goose and the heftier snow goose. The pair are a great example of what science calls sister species, which occur when a portion of one species takes an evolutionary step away from the rest, resulting in a species split. In this case, genetic studies suggest that the Ross's goose branched away from its snow goose relatives more than 2 million years ago, possibly because advancing glaciers separated the two populations. After spending millennia in isolation, the Ross's goose evolved to be about two-thirds the size of a snow goose, with a noticeably shorter neck, smaller bill, and higher-pitched voice, too. So next time you spot a flock of white geese, see if you can tell the sisters apart. We've got tips and tricks for distinguishing between look-alike species at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Bird Note leading the way out of this week's program. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for sharing your weekend with WISO. We've got more conversations and program highlights coming your way next weekend. Please join us then. Our theme music provided by Magnolia Bolthead. Until next time.